Case is still open, but we ain't had jack shit for months. You want to look at the files? It can probably be arranged.
That'd be great. What I'd really like to see are the crime scene photographs.
I'll try to clear it with Lieutenant Dolan, but I don't think he'll object. You heard he's in the hospital? He had a heart attack.
I was so startled I put a hand to my own heart, nearly knocking my glass over in the process. I caught it before it tipped, though a little wave of wine slopped out.
Dolan had a heart attack? That's awful. When was this?
Yesterday, right after squad meeting. He started having chest pains. Like, boom, he's in trouble. Guy looks like shit and he's short of breath. Next thing I know, he's out like a light. Everybody's scrambling around, doing CPR. Paramedics pulled him back from the brink. But it was really touch and go.
Is he going to be okay?
We hope so. He's doing fine, last I heard. He's over at St. Terry's in the cardiac care unit. Raising hell, of course.
Sounds like him. I'll try to get over there first chance I have.
He'd like that. You should do it. I talked to him this morning, and the guy's going nuts. Claims he doesn't like to sleep because he's scared he won't wake up.
He admitted that? I never knew Lieutenant Dolan to talk about anything personal, I said.
He's changed. He's a new man. It's amazing, he said. You ought to see for yourself. He'd be thrilled at the company. Probably talk your ear off.
I shifted the subject back to Lorna Kepler.
What about you? Do you have a theory about Lorna's death?
Cheney shrugged.
I think somebody killed her, if that's what you're after. Rough trade, jealous boyfriend. Maybe some other hooker thought Lorna was treading on her turf. Lorna Kepler loved risk. She's the kind who liked to teeter right out on the edge.
She have enemies?
Not as far as we know. Oddly enough, people seem to like her a lot. I say oddly because she was different, really unlike other folk. It was almost admiration on their part, because she was so out there, you know? She disregarded the rules and played the game her way.
I take it your investigation covered a lot of ground.
That's right, though it never came to much. Frustrating. Anyway, it's all there if you want to take a look. I can have Emerald pull the files once we get Dolan's okay.
I'd appreciate that. Lorna's mother gave me some stuff, but she didn't have everything. Just let me know and I'll pop over to the station and take a look.
Sure thing. We can talk afterward.
Thanks, Cheney. You're a doll.
I know that, he said. Just make sure you keep us informed and play it straight. If you come up with something, we don't want it thrown out of court because you've tainted the evidence.
You underestimate me, I said. Now that I'm working out of Lonnie Kingman's office, I'm an angel among women. I'm a paragon.
I believe you, he said.
His smile was lingering and his eyes held just a hint of speculation. I thought I'd probably said enough. I backed away and then turned, giving him a wave as I departed. Once outside, I drank in the quiet of the chill night air, picking up the faint scent of cigarette smoke trailing back at me from somewhere up ahead. I lifted my head and caught a glimpse of a man easing out of sight around a bend in the road, his footsteps growing faint. There are men who walk at night, shoulders hunched, heads bent in some solitary pursuit. I tend to think of them as harmless. But one never knows. I watched until I was certain he was gone. In the distance, low-lying, heavy cloud cover had been pushed up the far side of the mountain and now spilled over the top. All the parking spots were filled. Vehicles gleamed in the harsh overhead illumination like a high-end used car lot. My vintage VW looked distinctly out of place, a homely pale blue hump among the sleek, low-slung sports models. I unlocked the car door and slid onto the driver's seat, then paused for a moment, hands on the steering wheel, while I contemplated my next move. The single glass of white wine had done little to temper my wired state. I knew if I drove home, I'd just end up lying on my back, staring at the skylight above my bed. I fired up the ignition and then drove along the beach as far as State Street. I hung a right, heading north. I crossed the railroad tracks, jolting the radio to life. I didn't even realize I'd left the damn thing on. It seldom worked these days, but every now and then I could coax something out of it. Sometimes I'd bang on the dash with my fist, jarring forth news or a commercial. Other times, for no apparent reason, I'd pick up a baffling fragment of the weather. Problem was probably a loose wire or a faulty fuse, which is just a guess on my part. I don't even know if radios have fuses these days. At the moment, the reception was as clear as could be. I pressed a button, neatly switching from AM to FM. I turned the dial by degrees, sliding past station after station, until I caught the strains of a tenor sax. I had no idea who it was, only that the mournful mix of horns was perfect for this hour of the night. The cut came to an end, and a man's voice eased into the space. "That was Gatto Barbieri on sax, a tune called Picture in the Rain, from the movie soundtrack Last Tango in Paris. Music was composed by Gatto Barbieri, recorded back in 1972. And this is Hector Moreno, here on K-Spell, bringing you the magic of jazz on this very early Monday morning." His voice was handsome, resonant, and well-modulated, with an easygoing confidence. This was a man who made his living staying up all night, talking about artists and labels, playing CDs for insomniacs. I pictured a guy in his mid-30s, dark, substantial, possibly with a mustache, his long hair pulled back and secured with a rubber band. He must have enjoyed all the perks of local celebrity status, acting as an MC for various charity events. Radio personalities don't need even the routine good looks of the average TV anchor person, but he'd still have name recognition value, probably his share of groupies as well. He was taking call-in requests. I felt my thoughts jump a track. Janice Kepler had mentioned Lorna's hanging out with some DJ in her late-night roamings. I began to scan the deserted streets, looking for a payphone. I passed a service station that was shut down for the night. At the near edge of the parking lot, I spotted what must have been one of the last real telephone booths, a regular stand-up model with a bifold door. I pulled in and left the car engine running while I flipped through my notes, looking for the phone number I'd been given for Frankie's coffee shop. I dropped a quarter in the slot and dialed. When a woman at Frankie's coffee shop finally answered the phone, I asked for Janice Kepler. The receiver was clunked down on the counter, and I could hear her name being bellowed. In the background, there was a low-level buzz of activity, probably late-night pie-and-coffee types, tanking up on stimulants. Janice must have appeared because I heard her make a remark to someone in passing, the two of them exchanging brief comments before she picked up. She identified herself somewhat warily, I thought. Maybe she was worried she was getting bad news. "Hello, Janice? Kinsey Milhone. I hope this is all right. I need some information, and it seemed simpler to call than drive all the way up there." "Well, my goodness, what are you doing up at this hour? You looked exhausted when I left you in the parking lot. I thought you'd be sound asleep by now." "That was my intention, but I never got that far. I was too stoked on coffee, so I thought I might as well get some work done. I had a chat with one of the homicide detectives who worked on Lorna's case. I'm still out and about and thought I might as well cover more ground while I'm at it. Didn't you mention that Lorna used to hang out with a DJ on one of the local FM stations?" "That's right." "Is there any way you can find out who it was?" "I can try. Hang on." Without covering the receiver, she consulted with one of the other waitresses.
"Perry, what's the name of that all-night jazz show? What station?" "K-Spell, I think."
I knew that much. Thinking to save time, I said, "Janice?"
"What about the disc jockey? You know his name?"
In the background, somewhat muffled, Perry said,
"Which one? There's a couple."
Dishes were clattering, and the speaker system was pumping out a version of Up, Up, and Away with stringed instruments.
"The one Lorna hung out with. Remember I told you about him?"
I cut in on Janice. "Hey, Janice?"
"Perry, hold on."
"What, hun?" "Could it be Hector Moreno?" She let out a little bark of recognition. "That's right, that's him. I'm almost sure he's the one. Why don't you call him up and ask if he knew her?"
"I'll do that," I said.
"You be sure and let me know. And if you're still out running around town after that, come on up and have a cup of coffee on the house." I could feel my stomach lurch at the thought of more coffee. The cups I'd consumed were already making my brain vibrate like an out-of-balance washing machine. As soon as she hung up, I depressed the lever and released it, letting the dial tone whine on while I hauled up the phone book on its chain and flipped through. All the radio stations were listed at the front end of the K's. As it turned out, KSPL was only 6 or 8 blocks away. Behind me, from the car, I could hear the opening bars of the next jazz selection. I found another quarter in the bottom of my handbag and dialed the studio. The phone rang twice.
K-Spell, this is Hector Moreno.
The tone was businesslike, but it was certainly the man I'd been listening to. Hello, I said. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'd like to talk to you about Lorna Kepler.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
Chapter 4. Moreno had left the heavy door to the station ajar. I let myself in, and the door closed behind me, the lock sliding home. I found myself standing in a dimly lit foyer. To the right of a set of elevator doors, a sign indicated KSPL, with an arrow pointing down towards some metal stairs on the right. I went down, my rubber-soled shoes making hollow sounds on the metal treads. Below, the reception area was deserted, the walls and the narrow hallway beyond painted a dreary shade of blue and a strange algae green, like the bottom of a pond. I called, "Hello?" No answer. Jazz was being piped in, obviously the station playing back on itself. "Hello?" I shrugged to myself and moved down the corridor, glancing into each cubicle I passed. Moreno had told me he'd be working in the third studio on the right, but when I reached it, the room was empty. I could still hear faint strains of jazz coming in over the speakers, but he'd apparently absented himself momentarily. The studio was small, littered with empty fast food containers and empty soda cans. A half-filled coffee cup on the console was warm to the touch. There was a wall clock the size of the full moon, its second hand ticking jerkily as it made the big sweep. Click, 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 click. The passage of time had never seemed quite so concrete, or so relentless. The walls were soundproofed with sections of corrugated dark gray foam. To my left, countless cartons and news clippings were tacked to a corkboard. The balance of the wall space was taken up with row after row of CDs, with additional shelves devoted to albums and tape cassettes. I did a visual survey, as if in preparation for a game of concentration. Coffee mugs, speakers, a stapler, Scotch tape dispenser, many empty designer water bottles, Evian, Sweet Mountain, and Perrier. On the control board, I could see the mic switch, cart machines, a rainbow of lights, one marked two-track mono. One light flashed green, and another was blinking red. A microphone suspended from a boom looked like a big snow cone of gray foam. I pictured myself leaning close enough to touch my lips to the surface, using my most seductive FM tone of voice. "Hello, all you night owls. This is Kinsey Milhone here, bringing you the best in jazz at the very worst of hours." Behind me, I heard someone thumping down the hall in my direction, and I peered out with interest. Hector Moreno approached, a man in his early 50s, supported by 2 crutches. His shaggy hair was gray, his brown eyes as soft as dark caramels. His upper body was immense, his torso dwindling away to legs that were stick-like and truncated. He wore a bulky black cotton sweater, chinos, and penny loafers. Beside him was a big reddish-yellow dog with a thick head, heavy chest, and powerful shoulders, probably part chow, judging by the teddy bear face and the ruff of hair around its neck. "Hi, are you Hector?" "Kinsey Milhone," I said. The dog bristled visibly when I held out my hand. Hector Moreno propped himself on one crutch long enough to shake my hand.
"Nice to meet you," he said. "This is Beauty. She'll need time to make up her mind about you."
"Fair enough," I said. She could take the rest of her life as far as I was concerned. The dog had begun to rumble, not a growl, but a low hum, as if a machine had been activated somewhere deep in her chest. Hector snapped his fingers, and she went silent. Dogs and I have never been that fond of one another. Just a week ago, I'd been introduced to a boy pup who'd actually lifted his leg and piddled on my shoe. His owner had voiced his most vigorous disapproval, but he really didn't sound that sincere to me, and I suspected he was currently recounting, with snorts and guffaws, the tale of Bowser's misbehavior on my footwear. In the meantime, I had a Reebok that smelled like dog whiz, a fact not lost on Beauty, who gave it her rapt attention. Hector swung himself forward and moved into the studio, answering the question I was too polite to ask.
I collided with a rock pile when I was 12. I was spelunking in Kentucky, and the tunnel caved in. People expect something different, judging from my voice on the air. Grab a seat.
He flashed me a smile, and I smiled in response. I followed as he set his crutches aside and hoisted himself onto the stool. I found a second stool in the corner and pulled it close to him. I noticed that Beauty arranged herself so that she was between us. While Hector and I exchanged pleasantries, the dog watched us with an air of nearly human intelligence, her gaze shifting constantly from his face to mine. Sometimes she panted with an expression close to a grin, dangling, tongue dancing as if it's some private joke. Her ears shifted as we spoke, gauging our tones. I had no doubt she was prepared to intervene if she didn't like what she heard. From time to time, in response to cues I wasn't picking up myself, she would retract her tongue and close her mouth, rising to her feet with that low rumble in her chest. All it took was a gesture from him, and she dropped to the floor again, but her look then was brooding. She probably had a tendency to sulk when she wasn't allowed to feast on human flesh. Hector, ever watchful, seemed amused at the performance.
She doesn't trust many people. I got her from the pound, but she must have been beaten when she was young.
You keep her with you all the time? I asked.
Yeah, she's good company. I work late nights, and when I leave the studio, the town is deserted, except for the crazies. They're always out. You asked about Lorna. What's your connection?
I'm a private investigator. Lorna's mother stopped by my office earlier this evening and asked if I'd look into her death. She wasn't particularly happy with the police investigation.
Such as it was, he said. Did you talk to that guy, Phillips? What a prick he was.
I just talked to him. He's out of homicide and onto vice these days. What did he do to you?
He didn't do anything. It's his attitude. I hate guys like him. Little banty roosters who push their weight around. Hang on a sec.
He slid a fat cassette into a slot and depressed a button on the soundboard, leaning forward, his voice as smooth and satiny as fudge.
We've been listening to Phineas Newborn on solo piano, playing a song called The Midnight Sun Will Never Set. And this is Hector Moreno, casting a little magic here at K-Spell. Coming up, we have 30 minutes of uninterrupted music, featuring the incomparable voice of Johnny Hartman, from a legendary session with the John Coltrane Quartet. Esquire magazine once named this the greatest album ever made. It was recorded March 7, 1963, on the Impulse label, with John Coltrane on tenor sax, McCoy Tyner on piano, Jimmy Garrison on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums.
He punched a button, adjusted the studio volume downward, and turned back to me.
Whatever he said about Lorna, you can take it with a grain of salt.
He said she had a dark side, but I knew that much. I'm not sure I have the overall picture, but I'm working on that. How long had you known her before she died?
Little over 2 years, right after I started doing this show. I was in Seattle before that, but the damp got to me. I heard about this job through a friend of a friend.
Is your background in broadcast?
Communications, he said. Radio and TV production, video to some extent, though it never interested me much. I'm from Cincinnati originally, graduated from the university, but I've worked everywhere. Anyway, I met Lorna when I first got down here. She was a night owl by nature, and she started calling in requests. Between cuts and commercials, we'd sometimes talk for an hour. She began to drop by the studio, maybe once a week at first. Toward the end, she was here just about every night. 2:33, she'd bring donuts and coffee, bones for Beauty if she'd been out to dinner. Sometimes I think it was the dog she cared about. They had some kind of psychic affinity. Lorna used to claim they'd been lovers in another life. Beauty's still waiting for her to come back. 3 o'clock, she goes out to the stairs and just stands there looking up. Makes this little sound in her throat that'd break your heart.
He shook his head, waving off the image with curious impatience. What was Lorna like?
Complicated. I thought she was a beautiful, tortured soul. restless, disconnected, probably depressed. But that was just one part. She was split, a contradiction. It wasn't all the dark stuff.
Was she into drugs or alcohol?
Not as far as I know. She blew hot and cold. She was nearly hyper sometimes. If you want to get analytical, I'd be tempted to label her manic depressive, but that doesn't really capture it. It was like a battle she fought, and the downside finally won.
I guess we all have that in us.
I do, that's for sure.
You knew she did a porno film?
I heard about that. I never saw it myself, but I guess the word was out.
When was it shot? Any time close to her death?
I don't know much about that. She was out of town a lot on weekends. Los Angeles, San Francisco. Could have been one of those trips. I really couldn't say for sure.
So it was not something you discussed? He shook his head.
She enjoyed being tight-lipped. I think it made her feel powerful. I learned not to pry into her personal affairs.
Any idea why she did the film? Was it money?
I doubt it. Producer probably cleans up, but the actors get a flat rate. At least from what I've heard, he said. Maybe she did it for the same reason she did anything. Lorna flirted with disaster every day of her life. If you want my theory, fear was the only real sensation she felt. Danger was like a drug. She had to boost the dose. She couldn't help herself. Didn't seem to matter what anyone said. I used to talk till I was blue in the face. It never made any difference as far as I could see. This is just my observation, and I could be all wrong. But you asked, and I'm answering. She'd act like she was listening. She'd act like she agreed with every word you said, but then it washed right over her. She went right on doing it, whatever it was. She was like an addict, a junkie. She knew the life wasn't good, but she couldn't make the break.
Did she trust you?
I wouldn't say that. Not really. Lorna didn't trust anyone. She was like Beauty in that respect. She might have trusted me more than most.
Why was that?
I never came on to her, so I wasn't any kind of threat. With no sexual investment, she couldn't lose with me. She couldn't win either, but that suited us both. With Lorna, you had to keep your distance. She was the kind of woman, the minute you got involved, it was over, pal. That was the end of it. The only way you could hold on to her was to keep her at arm's length. I knew the rule, but I couldn't always manage it. I was hooked myself. I kept wanting to save her, and it couldn't be done.
Did she tell you what was going on in her life?
Some things. Trivia for the most part, just the day-to-day stuff. She never confided anything important. Events, but not feelings, you know what I mean? Even then, I doubt she ever really leveled with me. I knew some things, but not always because she told me.
How'd you get your information?
I have buddies around town. I'd get frustrated with her behavior. She'd swear she was playing straight, but I guess she really couldn't give it up. Next thing you know, she'd be picking up guys. Twosomes, threesomes, anything you want. People would see her and make a point of telling me, worried I was getting in over my head.
And were you?
His smile was bitter. I didn't think so at the time.
Did the rumors bother you?
Hell yes. What she did was dangerous, and I was worried sick. I didn't like what she was doing, and I didn't like people running in here talking about her behind her back. Tattletales, I hate that. I couldn't get them to quit. With her, I tried to keep my mouth shut. It was none of my business, but I kept getting sucked in. I'd be saying, "Why, babe, what's the point?" And she'd shake her head. "You don't want to know, heck. I promise. It's got nothing to do with you." The truth is, I don't think she knew. It was a compulsion, like a sneeze. It felt good to do it. If she held off, something tickled until it drove her nuts.
"You have any idea who was in her life besides you?"
I wasn't in her life. I was on the fringe, way out there. She had a day job, part-time at the water treatment plant. You might talk to them, see if they can fill you in. Most times I never even saw her before 3 a.m. She might have had some other kind of life entirely when the sun was up.
Ah, well, food for thought, I said. Anything else I should know?
Not that I can think of offhand. If something occurs to me, I can get in touch. You have a card?
I fished one out and placed it on the console. He looked at it briefly and left it where it was. I said, "Thanks for your time."
I hope I've been of help. I hate the idea someone got away with murder.
This is a start, at any rate. I may be back at some point.
I hesitated, glancing at the dog still lying there between us. The minute she sensed my look, she rose to her feet, which put her head just about level with the stool where I was perched. She kept her eyes straight ahead, gazing intently at the flesh on my hip, possibly with an eye toward a late evening snack.
"Beauty,"
he murmured, with scarcely any change of tone. She sank to the floor, but I could tell she was still thinking about a jaw full of gluteus maximus. "Next time I'll bring her a bone," I said. "Preferably not mine." I headed home through the business district, following a trail of stoplights that winked from red to green. The storefronts had been secured, plate glass windows ablaze with fluorescent lighting. The streets were bleached white with the spill of illumination. I passed a lone man on a bike, dressed in black. It was almost 1:30 a.m., traffic minimal, intersections wide and deserted. Most of the bars in town were still open, and in another half hour or so all the drunks would emerge, heading for the various downtown parking structures. Many buildings were dark. The homeless, bundled in sleep, blocked the doorways like toppled statues. For them, the night is like a vast hotel where there's always a room available. The only price they pay, sometimes, is their lives. At 1:45, I finally stripped off my jeans, brushed my teeth, and doused the lights, crawling into bed without bothering to remove my T-shirt, underpants, and socks. These February nights were too cold to sleep naked. As I eased toward unconsciousness, I found myself mentally replaying select portions of Lorna's tape. Ah, the life of the single woman in a world ruled by sexually transmitted diseases. I lay there, trying to think back to when I'd last had sex. I couldn't even remember, which was really worrisome. I fell asleep wondering if there was a cause and effect relationship between memory loss and abstinence. Apparently so, as that was the last thing I was aware of for the next 4 hours. When the alarm went off at 6 a.m., I rolled out of bed before my resistance came up. I pulled on my sweats and my running shoes, then headed into the bathroom where I brushed my teeth, avoiding the sight of myself in the mirror. One ill-advised glance had revealed a face fat with sleep and hair as stiff and matted as a derelict's. I'd snipped it off 6 months before with a trusty little pair of nail scissors, but I hadn't done much to it since. Now the sections that weren't sticking straight up were either flat or adrift. I was really going to have to do something about it one of these days. Given the 4 hours of sleep, my run was a bit on the perfunctory side. Often I tune into the look of the beach, letting sea birds and kelp scent carry me along. Jogging becomes a meditation, shifting time into high gear. This was one of those days when exercise simply failed to uplift. In lieu of euphoria, I had to make my peace with 300 calories worth of sweat, screaming thighs and burning lungs. I tacked on an extra half mile to atone for my indifference, and then did a fast walk back to my place as a way of cooling down. I showered and slipped into fresh jeans and a black turtleneck, over which I pulled a heavy gray cotton sweater. I perched on a wooden stool at the kitchen table and ate a bowl of cereal. I scanned the local paper in haste. No surprises there. While floods threatened the Midwest, the Santa Teresa rainfall averages were down, and there was already speculation of another drought in the making. January and February were usually rainy, but the weather had been capricious. Storms approached the coast and then hovered, as if flirting, refusing us the wet kiss of precipitation. High-pressure systems held all the rains at bay. The skies clouded over, brooding, but yielded nothing in the end. It was frustrating stuff. Turning to happier items, I read that one of the big oil companies was talking about building a new refinery somewhere on the south coast. That would be a handsome addition to the local landscape. A bank robbery, a conflict between land developers and opposing members of the county board of supervisors. I scanned the funnies while I sucked down my coffee, and then headed into the office, where I spent the next several hours assembling the balance of my tax receipts. Obnoxious. Having finished, I pulled out a standard boilerplate contract and typed in the details of my agreement with the Keplers. I spent the bulk of the day finishing the final report on a case I'd just done. The closing bill, with expenses, was something over $2,000. It wasn't much, but it kept the rent paid and my insurance intact. At 5, I put a call through to Janice, figuring she'd be up by then. Trini, the younger of the two daughters, answered the telephone. She was a chatty little thing.
When I identified myself, she said her mother's alarm was set to go off any minute. Berlin was making a run to the bank, and her father was on his way home from a job. That took care of just about everyone. Janice had given me the address, but Trini filled in directions, sounding pleasant enough. I retrieved my car from the public lot several blocks away. A steady stream of moving cars spiraled down the ramp as shoppers and office workers headed home. As I drove up Capillo Hill, the very air seemed gray, suede with twilight. Street lights flicked on like a series of paper lanterns strung festively from pole to pole. Janice and Mace Kepler owned a little house on the bluffs in a neighborhood that must have been established for merchants and tradesmen in the early 50s. Many streets overlooked the Pacific, and in theory, the area should have been pricey real estate. In reality, there was too much fog. Painted exteriors peeled, aluminum surfaces became pitted, and wooden roof shingles warped from the constant damp. Wind whistled off the ocean, forcing lawns into patchiness. The neighborhoods themselves were comprised almost entirely of tract housing, single-family dwellings thrown up in an era when construction was cheap and the floor plans could be purchased by mail from magazines. The Keplers had apparently done what they could. The yellow paint on the board and batten siding looked as if it had been applied within the year. The shutters were white, and a white split-rail fence had been constructed to define the yard. The lawn had been replaced by dense ivy, which seemed to be growing everywhere, including halfway up the two trees in the yard. In the driveway there was a blue-paneled truck emblazoned with a large cartoon replica of a faucet. A big teardrop of water hung from the spout. Mace Kepler's Plumbing, Heating, Air was lettered in white across the truck body. A small oblong emblem indicated that Kepler was a member of PHCC, the National Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. His state license number was listed along with the 24-hour emergency repairs he provided. Water leaks, sewer drains, gas leaks, and water heaters. And the credit cards he took. These days, doctors don't offer services that comprehensive. I pulled into the gravel driveway and parked my vehicle behind his. I left the car unlocked and peered briefly into the backyard before I climbed the low concrete steps to the front porch. Somebody in the family had a passion for fruit trees. A veritable orchard of citrus had been planted at the rear of the lot. At this season, all the branches were bare, but come summer, the dark green foliage would be lush and dense, fruit tucked among the leaves like Christmas ornaments. I rang the bell. There were muddy work shoes by the doormat. There was only a brief pause before Mace Kepler opened the door. I had to guess he'd been alerted to watch for my arrival. Given my incurable inclination to snoop, I was happy I hadn't paused to riffle through his mailbox. We introduced ourselves, and he stepped back to admit me. Even in his leather bedroom slippers, he was probably 6'4" to my 5'6". He wore a plaid shirt and work pants. He was in his 60s, quite hefty, with a broad face and a receding hairline. His deeply cleft chin seemed to have a period buried at its center, and a vertical worry line like a slash mark dissected the space between his eyes. On residential jobs, he probably hired younger, smaller guys to navigate the crawl space underneath the house.
"Janice is in the shower, but she'll be right out. Can I offer you a beer? I'm having one myself. I just got home from a hell of a day."
"No thanks," I said. "I hope I haven't picked a bad time." I waited by the door while he lumbered toward the kitchen to fetch himself a beer.
"Don't worry about it. This is fine," he said. "I just haven't had a chance to unwind yet. This is my daughter, Trini."
Trini glanced up with a brief smile and then went about her work, pouring a cocoa brown batter into a 9x13 aluminum cake pan. The hand mixer, its beaters still dripping brown goo, sat on the kitchen counter beside an open box of Duncan Hines chocolate cake mix. Trini tucked the pan in the oven and set a timer shaped like a lemon. She'd already opened a cardboard container of ready-mix fudge frosting, and I'd have bet money she'd helped herself to a fingerful. While my aunt had never really taught me to bake, she'd warned me repeatedly about the ignominy of the commercial cake mix, which she ranked right up there with instant coffee and bottled garlic salt. Trini was barefoot, wearing an oversized white T-shirt and a pair of ragged blue jean cutoffs. Judging from the size of her butt, she'd conjured up quite a few homemade cakes in her day.
Mace opened the refrigerator door and took out a beer. He found the flip in a drawer and levered off the cap, tossing the bottle top in a brown paper trash bag as he passed it. Trini and I murmured a hi to one another. Berlin, the older daughter, emerged from the hallway, wearing a pair of black tights and a man's white broadcloth dress shirt over them. Again, Mace introduced us, and we exchanged inconsequential greetings of the hi, how are you type. She was intent on rolling up her sleeves as she crossed into the open kitchen. She paused beside Trini and held her arm out for assistance. Trini wiped her hands and began to roll up Berlin's sleeve. At first glance, they were sufficiently similar to be mistaken for twins. They seemed to favor their father, both big girls and buxom, with heavy legs and thighs. Berlin was a dyed blonde, with big blue eyes framed in dark lashes. She had a clear, pale complexion and a lush, full mouth, vibrant with glossy pink lipstick. Trini had opted for her natural hair color, a double fudge brown, probably the shade Berlin was born with. Both had bright blue eyes and dark brows. Berlin's features were the coarser, or perhaps it was the bleached hair that gave her the appearance of tarnishness. Without Lorna's delicate beauty in the family for contrast, I would have said they were pretty in a slightly vulgar way. Even knowing what I knew about Lorna's promiscuity, she seemed to have had a classiness about her that the other two lacked. Berlin moved over to the refrigerator and pulled out a Diet Pepsi. She popped the tab and ambled out the back door onto a wooden deck that ran along the back of the house. Through the window, I watched as she settled on a chaise made of interwoven plastic strips. It seemed too chilly to be sitting out there. Her eyes caught mine briefly before she looked away. Beer in hand, Mace moved through the kitchen toward the den, indicating that I was to follow. As he closed the door behind us, I picked up the chemical scent of baking chocolate cake. Chapter 5. The den had been added onto the house by framing in one half of the two-car garage. Subflooring had been laid over the original concrete, and look-like oak tongue-and-groove vinyl planks had been installed on top of that. Even with the addition of an area rug, the room smelled like motor oil and old car parts. A sofa bed, coffee table, four chairs, an ottoman, and a rolling cart for the television set had been arranged in the space. In one corner was a filing cabinet and a desk piled high with papers. All of the furniture looked like garage sale purchases. Mismatched fabrics, worn upholstery, someone else's discards given another chance in life. May sank onto a battered brown naugahyde lounger, activated the mechanism that flipped the footrest into place. His mouth was crowded with bad teeth. The flesh along his jaw had softened with age, and he now had parentheses setting off the thin line of his mouth. He picked up the TV remote, punched the mute button, and then clicked his way through several channels until he found a basketball game in progress. Silently, guys bounded up and down the court, leapt, fell, and bumped one another sideways. If the sound had been turned up, I knew I'd hear the high-pitched shriek of rubber soles on the hardwood floor. The ball sailed into the basket as if magnetized, not even touching the rim half the time. Without invitation, I perched on the nearby ottoman, arranging myself so I was in his line of sight. "I take it Janice has told you about our conversation last night." I was prepared to make soothing noises about Lorna's participation in the pornographic film. Mace made no response. A fast food commercial came on, a 15-by-20-inch full-color burger filling the TV screen. The sesame seeds were the size of rice grains, and a slice of bright orange cheese drooped invitingly from the edge of the bun. I could see Mace's eyes fix on the picture. I'd always known I wasn't as compelling as a flame-broiled beef patty, but it was deflating nonetheless to see his attention displaced. I moved my head to the left, entering his visual frame of reference.
"She told me she wants to hire you to look into Lorna's death," he said, as though prompted by someone off stage.
"How do you feel about it?" He began to tap on the chair arm.
"Up to Janice," he said. "I don't mean to sound crass, but her and me have a difference of opinion with regard to that. She believes Lorna was murdered, but I'm not convinced. It could have been a gas leak, could have been carbon monoxide poisoning from a faulty furnace."
He had a big voice and big hands. Lorna's cabin had a furnace? I was under the impression her living quarters were pretty crude. A brief look of impatience flashed across his face.
Janice does the same thing. She takes everything literal. I'm just giving an example. Every item in that cabin was either old or broke down. You have a heater that's defective, and you can get yourself in a peck of trouble. That's the point I was trying to make. I see it all the time. Hell, that's what I do for a living.
I assume the police looked into the possibility of a gas leak. He shrugged that one off, hunching one beefy shoulder while he worked out a kink.
Bunged myself on the back trying to wrench a pipe off a slab, he said. I don't know what the police did. Point is, I think this whole business ought to be laid to rest. Seems to me this speculation about murder is just another way of keeping the subject open for discussion. I loved my daughter. She's as near perfect as you could want. She's a beautiful, sweet girl. But she's dead now, and nothing's going to change that. We got two daughters living, and we need to focus our attention on them for a change. You start hiring lawyers and detectives, all you're going to have is a lot of unnecessary expense in addition to the heartache.
I could feel my inner ears prick up. No outrage, no protest, no reference whatever to all the licking and sucking. To me, Lorna's prurient behavior left her short of near perfect and put her closer to wanton. Being wild didn't make her bad, but the word sweet was not quite the word that leapt to my mind. I said, "Maybe the two of you need to have another chat about this. I told her last night you'd have to agree."
"Well, we're not in agreement. I think the woman's got her head up her butt, but if that's what she wants, I'm willing to go along with it. We're all of us coping any way we can. If this makes her feel good, I won't interfere. But that doesn't mean I agree with her on the issue."
Oh, boy. Wait until the man saw the bill for my services. I didn't want to be caught in the middle of that dispute. "What about Trini and Berlin? Have you discussed this with them?"
"It's not up to them. It's me and her make decisions. The girls live at home, but we're the ones pay the bills."
"I guess what I'm really asking is how they're coping with Lorna's death."
"Oh, I guess we don't tend to talk about that much. You'd have to ask them yourself. I'm trying to put this behind us, not keep it all stirred up."
"Some people find it helpful to talk about these things. That's how they process what they've experienced."
"I hope I don't sound like a surly so-and-so on the subject, but I'm just the opposite. I just as soon drop it and get on with my life."
"Would you object to my talking with them?"
"That's between you and them, as far as I'm concerned. They're grown-ups. As long as they're willing, you can talk all you want."
"Maybe I'll catch them before I leave. We don't necessarily have to talk today, but I'd like to have a conversation with each of them soon. It's always possible Lorna confided something that might turn out to be significant."
"I doubt it, but you can ask."
"What hours do they work?"
"Burl mans the phone here, 8 to 5. I got a pager, and she makes sure I know about emergencies. She keeps my books, pays the bills, and handles the deposits. Trini's in the process of looking for work. She got laid off last month, so she's here most of the time."
"What's she do?" The series of commercials had finally come to an end, and his attention was focused on the TV set again. Two ex-athletes in suits were discussing the game. I let the matter pass, thinking I could ask her myself. There was a knock at the den door, and Janice peered in.
"Oh, hi. Trini said you were here. I hope I'm not interrupting."
She came into the den and closed the door behind her, bringing with her the scent of shower soap, deodorant, and damp hair. She was wearing a red and white checked shirt and red polyester stretch pants.
"I got a regular uniform for work," she said, her glance following mine.
She looked spiffier than I did, polyester or no.
"Did anyone offer you a beverage?"
I was surprised she didn't pull out an order pad and pen.
"Thanks, but I'm fine. Mace offered earlier."
I reached into my handbag and took out the contract, which I laid on the coffee table.
"I stopped by with this. I hope I'm not interrupting your supper preparations."
She waved a hand.
"Don't worry about it. Trini's taken care of that. Ever since she got laid off, it's like having live-in help. We don't eat until 8, which is hours from now anyway. Meantime, how have you been? I hope you got enough sleep. You look tired.
I am, but I am hoping to catch up tonight. I don't know how you work the night shift. It would kill me.
You get used to it. Actually, I prefer it. A whole different set of people come in at night. By the way, that offer of coffee still stands if you're ever up in that area when I'm on shift.
She picked up the contract, a simple one-page document spelling out the terms of our agreement.
I guess I better read this before I sign. How does this work? Is this hourly or a flat fee?
$50 an hour plus expenses, I said.
I'll submit a written report once a week. We can touch base by phone as often as you like.
The agreement authorizes my services and expenditures up to $5,000. Anything beyond that, we'll discuss if the time comes. You may decide you don't want to proceed, and if so, that's the end of it.
You'll probably need an advance. Isn't that how this is done?
Generally, I said. We spent a few minutes talking about the particulars while Mace watched the game.
This looks all right to me. Honey, what do you think?
She held out the contract for him, but he ignored her. She turned back to me.
I'll be right back. The checkbook's in the other room. Will $1,000 be all right?
That'd be fine, I said. She left the room, and I turned my attention to him.
It will save me some time if you can give me the names and addresses of Lorna's friends.
She didn't have any friends. She didn't have enemies either, at least as far as we know.
What about her landlord? I'll need his address.
26 Mission Run Road. Name is J.D. Burke. Her place was at the back of his property. I imagine he'd give you the tour if you ask him nice.
You have any idea why she might have been killed?
I already told you my opinion, he said.
Janice returned to the room, catching my last remark and his response.
Ignore him. He's a pill, she said. She took a swat at his head. You behave yourself.
She sat down on the couch with her checkbook in hand. From the glimpse I caught of the check register, it looked as though it had been a while since she'd done her subtraction. She seemed to favor rounding everything off to the nearest dollar, which made all the amounts end in zero. She wrote out the check, tore it off, and passed it over to me, making a note of the check number and the sum. Then she scribbled her name at the bottom of the contract and handed it to Mace. He took the pen and added his signature without glancing at the terms. The very gesture conveyed not indifference, but something close to it. I've been in business long enough to smell trouble, and I made up my mind to have Janice pay me as we went along. If I waited to submit a final bill of any substance, Mace would probably get his undies in a bundle and refuse to pay. I glanced at my watch.
I better go, I said. I have an appointment in 15 minutes on the other side of town.
I was lying, of course, but these people were beginning to give me a stomachache.
Could you walk me out? I asked.
Janice stood up when I did.
Be happy to, she said.
Nice meeting you, I murmured to Mace as I departed.
Yeah, ditto for sure.
Neither Berlin nor Trini was visible as we passed through the living room on our way to the door. As soon as we hit the front porch, I said, Janice, what's going on here? Have you told him about the tape? He doesn't act like he knows, and you swore you would do that.
Well, I know, but I haven't had a chance yet. He'd already gone to work when I got home this morning. This is the first opportunity I've had. I didn't want to mention it in front of Berlin or Trini.
Why not? They have a right to know what she was up to. Suppose they have information that's relevant. Maybe they're holding something back, trying to be protective of the two of you.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Do you really think so?
It's certainly possible, I said.
I guess I could tell them, but I hate to tarnish her memory when it's all we have.
My investigation may turn up worse than that.
Oh, Lord, I hope not. What makes you say that?
Wait a minute. Let's stop this. I can't be effective if you keep on playing games.
I'm not playing games, she said, her tone indignant.
Yes, you are. You can knock off the bullshit about Lorna, for starters. The detective I talked to says you knew what she was doing because he told you himself.
He did not.
I don't want to get into this did-to-did-not stuff. I'm telling you what he said.
Well, he's a damn liar, and you can tell him that's what I said.
I'll convey your position. The point is, you promised to tell Mace about the video. You're lucky I didn't open my big mouth and put my foot in it. I came this close to mentioning it. That'd be all right, she said with caution, apparently mistaking my statement for an offer.
I bet that'd be all right with you. You figure he's already hostile toward me, so what difference would it make? I can just imagine his reaction. Hey, no thanks. That's your job, and you better be quick.
I'll raise the subject at supper.
The sooner the better. Just don't leave me in the position of knowing more than he does. He's going to feel foolish enough as it is.
I said I'd take care of it, she said. Her manner was frosty, but I didn't care.
We parted company on that slightly strained note. I stopped by the bank on my way through town and deposited the check. I wasn't convinced the damn thing wouldn't bounce, and if I'd had any sense, I'd have waited until it cleared before I did any further work. I intended to head home. Under the trees, the February twilight had accumulated shadows. I was looking forward to an early supper and a good night's sleep. In the interest of efficiency, I did a detour as far as Mission Run Road in search of Lorna's former landlord. If he was home, I'd have a quick chat. If he was out, I'd leave a card with a note asking him to get in touch. The house was a two-story Victorian structure, white frame with green shutters and a wraparound porch. Like many such homes in Santa Teresa, this had probably been the main residence on agricultural land of considerable acreage. There was a time when this parcel would have been on the outskirts of town instead of close to its center. I could picture the orchards and fields being subdivided, other houses encroaching while owner after owner put money in the bank. Now what remained was probably less than 6 acres, populated with old trees and the suggestion of outbuildings converted to other use. As I moved up the walk, I could hear voices, one male, one female, raised in anger, though the subject matter wasn't audible. A door slammed. The man yelled something, but the point was lost. I went up wooden steps that were rough with flaking gray paint. The front door was standing open, the screen on the latch. I rang the bell. I could see linoleum in the hallway, and on the right, stairs going up to the second floor landing. One portion of the hallway had been sectioned off with two accordion gates, one near the stairway, the other halfway to the kitchen. Burke had a puppy or a kid, it was hard to say. Lights were on at the back of the house. I rang the bell again. A man called out from the kitchen and then appeared, heading in my direction with a dish towel tucked in his belt. He flipped on the porch light, peering out at me. "Are you J.D. Burke?" I asked.
"That's right."
His smile was tentative. He was in his mid to late 40s, with a lean face and good teeth, though one was chipped in front. He had deep creases on either side of his mouth and a fan of wrinkles at the outer corners of his eyes.
"My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator. Lorna Kepler's mother hired me to look into her death. Can you spare a few minutes?"
He glanced back over his shoulder and then shrugged to himself.
"Sure, as long as you don't mind watching me cook."
He unlatched the screen and held it open for me.
"Kitchen's back here. Watch your feet," he said.
He sidestepped an array of plastic blocks as he moved down the hall.
"My wife thinks playpens are too confining for kids, so she lets Jack play here, where he can see what's going on."
I could see that Jack had smeared peanut butter on all the stair spindles he could reach. I followed J.D. down a chilly hallway, made darker by mahogany woodwork and wallpaper somber with age. I wondered if the art experts could brighten the finish by cleaning away the soot, restoring all the colors to their once clear tones like an old masterpiece. On the other hand, how colorful could pale brown cabbage roses get? The kitchen was someone's depressing attempt to modernize what had probably been a utility porch to begin with. The countertops were covered with linoleum, rimmed with a band of metal where a line of dark gray grunge had collected. The wooden cabinets were thick with lime-green paint. The stove and refrigerator both appeared to be new, incongruous white appliances sticking out into the room. An oak table and two chairs had been tucked into an alcove, where a bay of windows with built-in benches looked out onto a tangled yard. The room was at least warmer than the hall we'd passed through.
"Have a seat."
"I'm fine. I can't stay long," I said. Really, I was reluctant to park my rear end on seats that were sticky with little fingerprints. A short person,
probably Jack, had made the rounds of the room, leaving a chair rail of grape jelly that extended as far as the back door, which opened onto a small glass-enclosed porch. J.D. leaned toward the burner and turned the flame up under his skillet while I leaned against the door jamb. His hair was a mild brown, thinning on top, slightly shaggy across his ears. He wore a blue denim work shirt, faded blue jeans, and dusty boots. A white paper packet marked with butcher's crayon sat on the counter, along with a pile of diced onions and garlic. He added olive oil to the skillet. I do love to watch men cook. J.D.? A woman's voice reached us from the front of the house.
Yeah?
Who's at the door? He looked toward the corridor behind me, and I turned as she approached.
This lady's a private investigator looking into Lorna's death. This is my wife, Lita. Sorry, but your name slipped right by me.
With the oil hot, he scooped up the onions and minced garlic and dropped them in the pan. I turned and held my hand out. Kinsey Milhone, nice to meet you. We shook hands. Lita was exotic, a child woman scarcely half Burke's height and probably half his age. She couldn't have been more than 22 or 23, small and frail with a dark pixie cut. Her proffered fingers were cold, and her handshake was passive. Burke said,
"Actually, you might know Lita's dad. He's a private investigator, too."
"Really? What's his name?"
"Kurt Selkirk. He's semi-retired now, but he's been around for years. Lita's his youngest. He's got 5 more just like her, a whole passel of girls."
"Of course I know Kurt," I said. "Next time you talk to him, tell him I said hi." Kurt Selkirk had made his living for years doing electronic surveillance, and he had a reputation as a sleazebag. Since Public Law 90-351 was passed in June of 1968, anyone who willfully uses, endeavors to use, or procures any other person to use or endeavor to use any electronic, mechanical, or other device to intercept any oral communication was subject to fines of not more than $10,000 or imprisonment for not more than 5 years. I know for a fact that Selkirk had risked both penalties on a regular basis. Most private investigators in his age range had made a living, once upon a time, eavesdropping on cheating spouses. Now the no-fault divorce laws had changed much of that. In his case, the decision to retire was probably the result of lawsuits and threats by the federal government. I was glad he'd left the business, but I didn't mention that. "What sort of work do you do?" I asked J.D.
"Electrician," he said.
Meanwhile, Lita, smiling faintly, moved past me in a cloud of musk cologne. Any oxen in the area would have been inflamed. Her eye makeup was elaborate. Smoky eyeshadow, black eyeliner, brows plucked into graceful arches. Her skin was very pale, her bones as delicate as a bird's. The outfit she was wearing was a long white sleeveless tunic cut low on her bony chest, and gauzy white harem pants through which her thin legs were clearly visible. I couldn't believe she wasn't freezing. Her sandals were the type that always drive me insane, with thin leather straps coming up between the toes. She moved out onto the glassed-in porch, where she busied herself with a swaddled infant, which she lifted from a wicker carriage. She brought the infant to the kitchen table, sliding onto the bench seat. She bared her quite weensy left breast, deftly affixing the baby like some kind of milking apparatus. As far as I could tell, the child hadn't made a sound, but it may have emitted a signal audible only to its mother. Jack, the toddler, was probably off somewhere finger-painting with the contents of his diaper. "I was hoping to see Lorna's cabin, but I didn't know if you had tenants in there at this point." I noticed Lita watched me carefully while I talked to him.
"Cabin's empty. You can go on back if you want. There hasn't been a way to rent it since the body was found. Word gets out and nobody wants to touch it, especially the shape she was in."
Burke held his nose with exaggerated distaste. Embarrassed, Lita said, "J.D.," as if he'd made a rude noise with his butt.
"It's the truth," he said.
He opened the butcher's packet and took out a pillow of raw ground beef, which he plunked into the skillet on top of the sautéed onions. He began to break up the bulk meat with his spatula. I could still see the densely packed noodles of beef where the meat had emerged from the grinder. looked like worms to me. The hot skillet was turning the bottom of the bulk ground beef from pale pink to gray. I'm giving up meat. I swear to God I am.
Can you remodel the place?
Right now I don't have the bucks, and it probably wouldn't help. It's just a shack.
What was she paying?
$300 a month. Might sound like a lot unless you compare it to other rentals in the area. It's really like a one-bedroom with a wood-burning stove I finally took out. People know a place is empty, and they'll steal you blind. They'll take all the light bulbs, if nothing else.
I noticed that in typical landlord assessment, the shack had been elevated to a one-bedroom apartment.
Did someone live there before she did?
Nope. My parents used to own the property, and I inherited when Mom died, along with some other rentals on the far side of town. I met Lorna through some people at the plant where she worked. We got talking one afternoon, and she told me she was looking for a place with some privacy. She'd heard about the cabin and asked if she could see it. She fell in love with it. I told her, look, it's a mess, but if you want to fix it up, it'd be fine with me. She moved in 2 weeks later, without really doing much.
Was she a party person?
Not to my knowledge.
What about friends? Did she have a lot of people back there?
I really couldn't say. It's way back in the back. There's like this little private dirt road going in off the side street. You want to see it, you probably ought to drive your car around and come in that way. Used to be a path between the two places, but we don't use it anymore, and it's overgrown by now. Most of the time, I didn't see if she had company or not because the foliage is so dense. Winters, I might catch lights, but I never paid much attention.
Did you know she was hustling?
He looked at me blankly.
Turning tricks, Lita said.
J.D. looked from her face to mine.
What she did was her business. I never considered it my concern.
If he was startled by the revelation, it didn't show on his face. His mouth curved down in a display of skepticism while he poked at the cooking beef.
Where'd you hear about that? He asked me.
From a vice detective. Apparently a lot of hookers work the classy hotels where the high rollers hang out. Lorna had done outcall, but she upgraded to independent.
I guess I'll have to take your word for it.
So far as you knew, she didn't bring clients here.
Why would she do that? You want to impress a fella, you'd hardly bring him back to some little shack in the woods. You'd be better off at the hotel. That way he'd get stuck for all the drinks and stuff.
That makes sense, I said. I gather she was careful to keep her private life private, so she probably didn't like to mix the two anyway.
Tell me about the day you found her.
Wasn't me. It was someone else, he said. I'd been out of town, up at Lake Nacimiento for a couple of weeks. I don't remember the exact timetable offhand. I got home, and I was taking care of some bills came in while I was gone, and realized I didn't have a rent check. I tried calling a bunch of times and never got any answer. Anyway, a couple days after that, this woman came to the door. She'd been trying to get in touch with Lorna herself, and she'd gone back there to leave her a note. Soon as she got close, she picked up the stink. She came and knocked on our door and asked us to call the police. She said she was pretty sure it was a dead body, but I felt like I ought to check it out first.
You hadn't noticed anything before?
I'd been aware of something smelling.